on the line right now, we have Jesse Thorne, who, yes, that Jesse Thorne from Bullseye on NPR and head of the Maximum Fun Network and everything. And just and put this on and all kinds of stuff. Jesse, welcome.
Thank you. You may be overestimating the value of my name in Limerick.
No. I was excitedly telling everyone. I was like, oh, Jesse Thorne is going to be on. Can you believe it? And co-host of the Judge John Haldeman Show. And we'll get into all of it.
Yeah.
But and I won't take you too long because I know you're very busy. So, you know. But, yeah. So you started doing your show, which then became Bullseye, which is a fantastic show, can I just say. Your interview skills are just... Everyone always gushes about that anyway. But you started your show, Sound of Young America. Yes, I wrote that down because I kept wanting to say the voice and I was like, don't say voice, stupid, say sound. Sound of Young America in 1999. And then this is the bit that caught me off guard. You started the podcast of your show in 2004, which is so early.
I didn't even have iTunes. Podcasts existed for 6 months or something.
Yeah. It's crazy, crazy. And that, of course, spun off into Jordan Jesse Go and Bullseye and everything. And because it was a podcast, you started the Maximum Fun Network. But what I want to go back to the start, though, is what brought you into doing the radio show in the first place in your college?
Well, I went to the University of California at Santa Cruz, which is... This, you know, it's a public university, and Santa Cruz is a coastal town that's south of San Francisco, about an hour and a half. And the campus is this big kind of mountain forest. And it's a beautiful place. It's always wet. It's a little bit like Return of the Jedi. If you think of where the Ewoks live in Return of the Jedi, that's basically the UC Santa Cruz campus. And I was there, and I knew that I didn't want to act. I had gone to an arts high school and had acted, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day for my entire high school career. I knew I was not that talented. And but I knew that I loved performing. So this was the days before you could buy a digital video camera that was worth its salt for a small enough amount of money that a broke teen could afford it. And there was no television station on campus. If you were a film major, you got a camera your senior year for one semester. And so really I turned on the college radio station one day, and we were lucky to have a pretty powerful college radio station. And I listened to it and I thought, well, gosh, I bet I could do that. And I went down to the station and they gave me a little tour. And the thing that I remember most vividly is I had imagined this big complicated production going on.
Yeah.
When in reality, I was like, oh, so up is louder and down is quieter.
Yeah.
And so I pretty much recruited the two funniest people I knew in college, and we went there with the plan to make a very ambitious show, which quickly collapsed. And eventually we pretty much landed on doing about half an hour of bits and a half hour live interview on the show. And, you know, by the time we were getting the especially the comedy people that we most admired, you know, the Upright Citizens Brigade and stuff like that. It was like, oh, we're actually doing something. And, you know, I was lucky that my, you know, my buddies from college were, they really wanted to do something, really wanted to work hard and make something that was worth making. You know, that Jordan Jesse Go, my co-host Jordan, he was... You know, I was 19, he was 18. I was his resident advisor. I was the boss of his residential hall. And, you know, our friend Gene, who co-hosted with us, he's a producer on Big Brother now. And, you know, we just, we were ambitious for slackers.
I was going to say, I mean, like, to have that kind of, to do an arts program, basically, I mean, you know, it's an interview show, really, but to be doing that kind of a thing at 19, I don't know if I would have done it at 19. I would have been just like goof offs, and the humor wouldn't have been good. It would have just been like fart jokes and stuff. It wouldn't have been anything.
I mean,
good.
I'm not sure that the humor was good. I remember we had a running bit a running bit that was us talking to a record of whale sounds.
I wish I could say I've never done something similar.
We did that once, then thought we should do it more times.
See, now that's too far for me now.
But, and you know, like I think we ended up doing, I think we ended up doing an interview show because we realized that writing an hour of material the night before we had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and wander across the campus because the buses weren't running yet to do a morning radio show was too ambitious by half. So we realized, like, if we just called Dick Dale, the king of the surf guitar, at his trailer in the desert, that we could fill half a show just with that. But, you know, we also, I can't speak to why Jordan and Gene were doing, were working so hard on the show. For me, it was about the fact that I had put myself in a position where, I mean, I got like, you know, I've got like drama of the gifted child perfectionism issues where I have a hard time starting anything because I'm worried that it's not going to be exactly right. When you have to go on the radio every week, like the choices are you do it or there's, you're breaking the law by not being present for emergency alerts. So it was, you know, it was a way to force ourselves to do something every week for, you know, almost the entirety of our college careers and then beyond. And we, you know, I mean, I know I was motivated primarily by the fear of embarrassing myself. So, you know, you work hard so you don't look like a dope. And I'm sure we did look like a dope, don't get me wrong, but less than we would have had we been lazing around. I mean, I remember listening to people's college radio shows, and our station had some, you know, some people who were unpaid volunteers but had been doing their shows for many years and were really important parts of the community, you know? And then sometimes it was just like a 20-year-old playing Throbbing Gristle songs because they thought it was funny, you know? And we thought, like, I think we thought maybe we could do something that would be distinctive but also something that people might want to actually listen to.
So you were mature even as, like, 19. Like, that's pretty, like, because I would have done that, I think, at 19. I would have played, like, Throbbing Gristle. I would have said, this is Lanai, people, you know? And that would have been just it. It would have been just, like, a weird, like, art thing to me. It wouldn't have been, like, a proper program, you know? I wouldn't have had the force that I got.
But you're 20 now. It's different.
But, no, well, then you put it out as a podcast. And in 2004, when there was no podcasts, and that got then picked up by, was it, it wasn't
Michael,
NPR.
There were podcasts. There were over six podcasts.
I'd never heard of it, but I was thinking back to 2004, and I was asking some people, and I was like, did you know about podcasts 2004? They were like, no.
I mean,
I was
it
like,
was,
yeah, no, me neither.
It was a time when you had to manually put podcasts onto your iPod. It was before iTunes had podcasting support.
Yeah. But, so MaximumFun.org, when did that start exactly? When was the starting date in that?
I mean, I I had registered a domain called splangy.com, which was just a nonsense word that was in an Upright Citizens Brigade sketch. And I talked to Matt Besser of the Upright Citizens Brigade once, years ago, and he said he tried to name his production company Splangy because it was a word he had said in an Upright Citizens Brigade sketch, and he was very vexed that someone had already registered that domain. But I figured it needed a little bit of a better name. I don't know if Maximum Fun is a good name. It was a little embarrassing. But, yeah, I mean, basically it was the original idea was I'm going to run this very roughly like a public radio station, which, you know, here in the States are primarily supported by membership. And I thought, I should do more than just this one show if I'm going to ask people for money. And then by the time I had kind of built some infrastructure, you know, figured out how to ask for money and, you know, that kind of thing, how to host shows, et cetera, I thought, well, I built this thing and there was a show called Stop Podcasting Yourself.
Yeah.
That
fantastic show.
People had been talking about in the forum for our shows, the message board. And, And I thought, I'll listen to this show. And I listened to it. I thought it was really good. And I just sent them an email and was like, hey, I liked your show. Do you want to like team up? And they said, yes, that show's still going. And it's an amazing show.
Very good.
Still one Brilliant. Of my favorite Max Fun shows.
You get a sense of community in Max Fun, and everyone seems genuinely proud to be part of the network as well. You really do get a sense of, yeah, I'm really happy to be part of this. They always like shout out other shows. You get a sense of, you definitely, and I found so many podcasts because I would have discovered your network through the Judge John Hodgman podcast, which, yes, it is Jack John Hodgman as well, folks. And, it's, I would have discovered it through that, and then I would have discovered yourself as you're the bailiff on that show. And that is a great show, by the way. It's one of my favorite. That got me through the pandemic, I gotta say. That was a brilliant show. That and Bulls, I really did help me out.
Kind of got me through the big pandemic, too. I had a very tough time. And, you know, John came on my show on The Sound of Young America when I was doing it in my apartment, right after I sold my car and bought that telephone hybrid. And he coincidentally came on my show about 5 days before he got famous. And his generosity towards me and his kindness towards me just never ceased in the many years since. And I just, you know, we came to be very close friends, but I've never lost my immense admiration for him. And it's funny, like that show used to be a side thing that he did when he wasn't busy being famous, basically.
Yeah.
And it's continued to grow over the many years we've done it very steadily. Like a lot of stuff we do at Max Fun. It grows steadily, not exponentially. And at this point, you know, I just talked to him the other day. We had kind of a business meeting. And we were both marveling. We're like, wow, this show that used to just be the thing we did to fill time, you know, it was like he was trying to sell some extra books, and I just thought it would be fun. Like this, for both of us, like this is the main thing that pays our mortgage. You know, we're like, wow, we actually made this into an actually successful thing. You know, and Hodgman, I think, always figured if he became actually successful, it would be as a television writer performer, and he certainly has continued to be successful as a television writer performer, but I don't think he ever expected that the center of his diagram of, you know, work and success and earnings would be the podcast.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's how it goes sometimes. It's a fake judge show. It's like it's a real judge show, but he's a fake.
Oh, I should
judge.
Have said that. Sorry.
It's like, you know, we have these syndicated television judge shows in the United States, Judge Judy and whatnot, the People's Court. Over here as well. And it's like that, but it's a comedy show. So it's the disputes are very much real, but they're not. Somebody stole my car. They're like they're domestic. They're friend things and domestic things and
the
things,
funniest
things
one...
about feelings.
One of the ones that stuck in my head, they're all really funny, but the one that stuck in my head was where a guy brought his dad in because he wanted him to stop making dad jokes when they were at a beautiful venue or something like that. They were at some mountain is hiking, and his dad would make a joke, and he was like, please, just please,
The
just
dad
stop.
Joke one that I remember the most is a dad who, no matter what restaurant they're at, would try and order the Kung Pao chicken. And
I can't remember that one, actually.
I think Hodgman correctly identified that, you know, and he would he would also do it in other customers. Like, he would do it at toll booths on roads. He'd be like, they'd be like, $4, please. And he'd be like, can I have the Kung Pao chicken? And I think Hodgman correctly identified, you know, one of the things about the show is that even though it's a comedy show, I think John is a very wise guy. And he really tries to find the kind of emotional center of these disputes. And for that one, at the emotional center, ultimately, was the fact that while this was, I think we both admitted, a pretty funny dad joke, it also was something that was both racially charged and was an abuse of the power differential between a customer and a customer service worker.
Yeah.
And that worker would not have the power in that situation to voice their discomfort or object to being made the subject of a joke. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, my favorite one of all time is without question, this one that was called Der Fliederhaus, which was AKA the Bat Brothers. And it was these two brothers who bought a house together in rural Kansas to save money. They bought this house for like $60,000. Mm-hmm. And which as an Angeleno is just insane to me that you could just buy an entire house for $60,000. But they bought this house together, and the only problem with this house was that there was a hole in the bathroom and bats were getting in. And the dispute was between these two guys. It was very real. It was one of them wanted to spend, I think it was $3,000 to fix the hole.
Yeah.
The other one said, we bought this house to save money. We can't spend $3,000 on some hole.
Yeah.
What we should do is we agree to keep the door to the bathroom closed at all times. So it's like a bat airlock. And if any bats get in, we always have a dictionary in the bathroom to hit the bats with. And it was so real. And I think, if I remember correctly, John's ultimate ruling involved kind of establishing a hole fixing fund that would be funded by instances of a bat getting into the house. And, you know, he ultimately saw that, like, the relationship between these two brothers and the fact that they were trying to manage their finances together was all at the center of this, not bats. And that they had to find some way to have a shared relationship in this home, and that this bat jar, where they had to put bat money anytime a bat got into the house, was the way that they would find a common ground between the two of them.
I think it is. I think the fact that...
Michael, there was a bat hole in their house.
In the bat room, which is the perfect place for us.
Oh my gosh, they're taking a shower and a bat comes in there? My gracious.
Just peeping on you.
$60,000 house in Kansas.
I think the fact that it spun off, though, from Bullseye makes sense, though, because there is an emotional honesty to John's analysis of it. Sometimes you do get to, like, sometimes it is like a funny kind of answer, but sometimes you say, like, it is like a real thing, and it's, you're really talking to people. You're not like going, oh yeah, this is goofy, whatever, silly. You're really talking to the person, and I think it makes sense that it spun off from Bullseye in that way.
I think in the early days, I pushed for the show to have more conflict. And what we found over time, this is something, when I say we, I mean mostly John. What John found over time was that the special thing about the show was getting to know the people.
Yeah.
And the conflict was a medium to get to know the people. It was an in that we had to find the emotional lives of just regular folks around the country and eventually around the world.
Yeah.
And John's sincere interest in meeting people, in talking to, like, John is an actual extrovert, which is kind of amazing to me. But, you know, we do live shows and he'll sit and talk to people after the show, signing autographs and doing whatever for hours. And it's not because he wants the ego gratification. I mean, he's not opposed to the ego gratification, but I don't think it's for that. Like, I don't think it's because he is a narcissist. It's because he sincerely enjoys talking to people and getting to know them, even if it's, you know, 2 or 3 minutes at a time. And he wants to give each person 2 or 3 minutes so that he can feel like he made a connection with them and learn something about them. And that's what the show is. It's John's very sincere interest in learning about people, learning about their emotional lives, and to some extent trying to help them understand themselves.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. You're awesome. You're brilliant. Such a nice man. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm very grateful.
All right.